Corporate Finance, Mindy and Robin, you're ready. City Finance will come to order. Welcome to everyone. It's good to see everyone again. Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, co-chair Wilken, and myself. We have one new member of Senate Finance this year, Senator Stedman. It's a pleasure to have you here. We look forward to your expertise and joining us in this endeavor for the year. We've been joined by Lieutenant Governor Lehman, who will be joining us at the table later. And Senator Con Bundy. I thought it would be nice today if we could each introduce our finance committee staff, so for the use, so that every other committee member knows who to be looking at when the senator's staff is needed. Senator Bundy, would you begin introducing your staff, please?
The finance committee staff is Lynn Smith. Lynn, how many years have you been there?
Been finance?
No, you've been
there for about
2 or 3. So I say senior with some credibility, and I'm very pleased to have her with me. Lynn will be with me.
That was very clever of you to begin at 12. Senator Hoffman?
I have Timothy Grusendorf.
Tim Grusendorf?
Timothy Grusendorf.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Thank you. I've got Dr. David Gray here, who's got a PhD, and he's my senior finance person, and has been since time immemorial.
Exactly. And Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. My finance staff is Lucky Schultz. Lucky and I have been friends for probably 30 years, has a master's degree in contract management and management. Graduated the Air Force Academy, and we met when we worked at British Petroleum together 25 years ago, and Lucky has been a management consultant in teaching managers how to run businesses and how to handle their finances, and this is his second year with us.
You're lucky to have
Senator Stedman.
And with me is Miles Baker. He's my lead guy in the office, and he graduated from Annapolis, spent some time in the Marines, so he's in charge of the office down there also. Run like a Marine camp, so if things go good. And then he also has a master's in marketing, so he keeps an eye on what I say in the public, and if I step on my tongue, he lets me know. And he's been very helpful. And we are, as mentioned earlier, the junior member on the committee, and also he would be the junior staff.
Thank you very much.
It'll be an interesting year.
Co-chair Wilken.
Morning, Madam Chair. Morning, members of the committee. Nice to be back. Didn't we just leave this table? Given my inadequacies, folks thought I needed two people to help me. So back again for the ninth year is Sheila Peterson. You all know her. And back on the Senate side is James Armstrong. And James has worked, you remember him with Senator Donnelly for a few years, and then went off and worked for Mayor Wirch, and then was back last couple of years in the House. So those two will be a tag team to try to make it look like I know what I'm doing. And after the first 2 weeks, I'm blessed to have them, and I think they'll serve the committee well. So welcome, and thanks for your work.
And I'm pleased to have with us this year Tracy Carpenter and Ginger Blaisdell. Most of you probably already know them, but they have a vast amount of experience, having come through several ways of getting at numbers and information about the state budget system. So thank you for being here. We look forward to a great year. One of the things I do want to remind you first and foremost is the importance of speaking into the microphone. As committee members, we are supposed to be addressing the chair, and the voice goes into the microphone, not to the speaker, not to the witness, or to another member, because it's very important for them that we speak into the microphone. We have back this year Mindy Rowland, who's our committee assistant, and is her eighth session. Robin Paul, committee secretary, Robin's fourth session. And this year, we're joined by Rose Foley, who's the finance page. She was born in Gustavus and apparently the first baby girl ever born there. She was raised in Juneau and Gustavus, spending summers with her dad commercial fishing and clubbing. She graduated from Juneau Douglas High in 97, from the University of California, Santa Cruz in June 2003 with a BA in legal studies. She's planning to go back to law school and is going to use her experience here to help her in that regard. Welcome, Rose.
Thank you.
Okay, just as a reminder, the copy of bills referred to Senate Finance are in the file cabinet at your knees. Supporting material for bills on the calendar will be available the afternoon of the day prior to the hearing. You may take the files to your office, but you are responsible for returning them. And again, on the microphones, please speak into the microphone for the proper recording. And another item on the recording is paper rustling is picked up and disrupts the flow of the information, as well as the swinging doors also disrupt the recording of the information. So if you're entering or leaving, be sure that you catch the door and let it and ease the slam. Amendments to bills being heard should be submitted to Mindy as soon as possible for numbering and copying. And we understand that our staff here can be bribed with chocolate. So if there's needing anything you need quickly, that might be the way to get to their heart. Senator Wilkin, any additional comments?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
We will take a brief recess while we turn over the gavel.
Bill today, Senate Bill 62. Senate Bill 62 was sponsored by Senate Rules by request of the governor. It appropriates $695,900 to the Division of Elections for increased operating costs for the fiscal year ending June 30 of 2005. At the present time, the Division of Elections is expected to run out of money by the end of February. With us today is Lieutenant Governor Lehman. And Lieutenant Governor, if you'd join us at the table, and Director of Elections, Laura Grazier. Laura? And I think Laura is going to present the bill for our consideration. Good morning.
Morning.
Morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chairman, committee members. It's good to be back at the table. For those of you three who are new to this committee, I used to have an office right next door, and I would always be almost on time to the start of these committee meetings. I had all of 15 feet to get here. And I just want to say it's good to be back and good to see so many people on staff who were here before. In many respects, I miss my participation in this part of the institution. I commend you for your work, and I wish you well as you do it. I did want to have a few brief remarks about this legislation, and then allow Director Glazer to go through some detail on it, and then, if you wish, I'll come back to the portion of it that deals with the reprinting of the ballots. I know that that has caught the interest of a number of people in the media. There have been a number of misrepresentations about that issue, and I'm happy to talk about what happened and why it happened and where we go from here in dealing with it. And so with your permission, I'll just go through and just offer a few quick comments and then let Laura Glazer go through some detail as she steps through some of the issues. My first thought is that I don't like supplemental requests. I didn't like it when I was a legislator, and I don't like them now. But we have to also recognize that a supplemental request does not always represent failure. And in this case, a portion of this, a substantial portion, represents success, and in some cases, spectacular success. We had this past election cycle, we set a record for voter participation. We had 25,000 more voters than the last highest election cycle ever in Alaska's history. That, I believe, is a good thing. I think each of us would also concur with that. We also set a record for the number of absentee ballot requests. At 61,000, that's about twice as many as the previous high that we've ever seen. Of course, this comes with a price. That means that we have to process the requests, and we also have to handle the voters. In addition to that, at the same time, the division has to respond to initiatives and also to a recall petition. This past year, there were 5 initiatives and a recall petition. The division has to hire the employees to go through and review signatures and count them and do all those responses. And Laura will go through the detail. Also, she hired outside counsel to advise her on an issue where she, by statute, is responsible for deciding how the recall will proceed. In that case, it wasn't me. It was the director of the division had to do that. There's a cost associated with that outside counsel. One other element of this, and it's a substantial one, over $100,000, is the cooperation of the state with local government. In this case, it was the municipality of Anchorage. I believe that that was a good thing to do. It increased the cost of the division, but Anchorage paid for it. And so, you know, I guess in one way you'll see it increases the cost of the state, but we got the revenue. It's going to end up being a wash. In this particular case, the municipality, actually it was the school district, but so the school district through the municipality wanted to have a bond election concurrently with the general election. That would save the municipality a lot of money, and it, you know, and we analyzed it and concluded that we could do the election at the same time. And so that's part of the cost. And then one other element, while it didn't add, as far as we can determine, didn't add to the cost, but it is something that we did, is we implemented for the first time, it was at our request and your wholehearted endorsement, what we call the Youth Vote Ambassador Program. And what we did with this is hire 16 and 17-year-old students to help work in the polls. The idea behind this is to train young people about poll working and voting so they in turn can be a good example to other young people. We want to encourage young people to vote. We also want to get them hired early so we can end up replacing, I guess we can say, the graying workforce that we have in poll workers. And, you know, we just have a need for a lot of poll workers in the division. And this was very much a success this year. All the young people have told us that they enjoyed the experience and would like to come back and to do it again. So I say these things and just to say that some of this, a substantial amount of this, represents success, and we ought to be very proud of that success. There is a portion of it, the reprinting of the ballots, and I'll go into detail after Laura does her part, that I wish didn't happen. And it shouldn't have happened, but it did, and the division had to respond to it, and I'll be happy to go into more detail after Ms. Glazer does her presentation.
Mr. Chairman, would you just like me to go through the highlighted expenditures?
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot where I was sitting. We'll go through the highlighted expenditures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The largest expenditure was additional personal services costs of approximately $304,000. That was to hire, we brought in 13 more temporary workers, and that was in the director's office alone to process the petitions. We were processing petitions simultaneously with the recall petition, with doing data entry for absentee ballot requests. So there was an incredible burden. Additionally, most of those temporaries were working excessively long hours, so there was a great deal of overtime. Those of us in management staff also put in long hours, and that's not reflected in overtime, but we do have in the reorganization two range 17s that put in a great deal of overtime all of it was real work, all that you would want them to do, but that did add to our costs. Next was the ballot reprinting costs, broken down in the memo that I sent to the co-chair. The ballot reprinting came to about approximately $203,000. The transportation of the paper, obviously, there were elections going on all over the country. There was a great draw on paper. It was very difficult for us to locate the paper in a timely manner and get that turned around. We worked with the ballot printer, a gentleman in Homer, it's an Alaskan printer. He worked with us to help reduce costs, but more importantly, to do an incredible turnaround time. That gentleman, you know, deserves a badge of honor because he worked in his community, Homer. People volunteered to help get that printing turned around, and it's a great Alaskan success story that we did turn it around so quickly. We also have destruction issues because we had ballots that were printed and ready to be mailed. Obviously, there could be no confusion as there was different ballot language. Those ballots had to be destroyed before the new ballots arrived in the regional offices. And then very minimal cost in personal services. The division, as Lieutenant Governor spoke to earlier, entered into a contract with the Municipality of Anchorage to add their bond questions to the general election ballot. And we did that. A copy of the contract is in your packets. It is part of legislative intent that we entered into this. The precedent-setting case for this was when the state added a Municipality of Anchorage question regarding the Winter Olympics to an election ballot, so this is not the first time that the state has worked with the municipality or a local government on an issue. I would like to say that the municipality has not paid yet. We're still totaling all the costs, so the Lieutenant Governor probably didn't tell him. But we're still totaling, literally as of yesterday, additional costs. So, but they do know that it's coming. We anticipated, we set them at a 90,000 thinking that was it. You'll see the contractual language the additional costs as they were incurred. Independent counsel, Lieutenant Governor spoke that there was a recall petition turned into the division. We requested independent counsel and were given independent counsel, and we still owe the Department of Law over $37,000 for those services, the contractual service. We conducted two recounts, one for House District 5 requested by House candidate Tim June, and one statewide recount requested by Alaskans for Fair Elections. Current statute provides that the House district recount should cost $750 and that a statewide recount should cost $10,000. Both of those entities paid their bond, but the costs were excessive, and to date the costs are over $39,000 to conduct those recounts. We did them simultaneously to try and reduce costs and to utilize the people that we had to bring in temporaries to process. We had over 20 machines running and people set up at each machine, so we did conduct them simultaneously, but that's a conglomerate cost.
If I can interrupt for a moment. Senator Bundy?
Thank you. I'm sorry for the interruption. That $39,000, was that the total cost of the recount, or was that just the statewide recount?
Thank you, Senator Bundy, through the chair. I'm sorry that it wasn't more clear. It is the total cost. So in the general fund, there has been deposited $10,750.
And if I might, Senator Bundy, Chair, could you give us a figure of the total cost of just the statewide?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I don't believe the costs were broken down that way, again, because we ran them simultaneously to reduce the costs and to utilize the services that we had, and I had the regional supervisors in.
If I might, what I'm trying to get at is a comparison between the bond and the actual cost, and sometime in the future, if you get a moment, if you could just even give me an approximate figure, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly, Senator Bundy.
Senator Huffman?
On that point, Mr. Chairman, what was the justification for having the costs well in excess of three times the amount that was anticipated?
Senator Huffman, through the chair, I'm not sure what you're asking. Are you asking why we spent more than we were given?
Yes, well, no, you said that the statewide count was going to cost about $10,000, and the House district was going to cost $750,000, and it's $39,000.
Excuse me, Senator Huffman, through the chair. You know, the statute requires, and it's been many years since that statute's been amended, requires those who are interested in requesting a recount, and those were the totals that are statutorily required at this time. And then the state still has to do it regardless of the costs.
How old are those statutes? They're that old.
I'm sorry, I don't know, but they are. I don't know my...
Before you vote, so Laura, so if I look at 39.8, is it 39.8 plus 10 plus 750 is the total? So that's not the net number. So the net number is 39.8 minus 10 minus 750?
Mr. Chairman, yes, but the division doesn't get the 10 and the 10,000 and the 750. It's deposited into the general fund.
Okay.
So it's a cost that we absorb.
Okay. Lieutenant Governor?
Mr. Chairman, I'm loath to correct my division director. She did make a statement just a little while ago where she said the costs were excessive. I believe that could have been better stated. The costs exceeded the bond. I don't believe, nor does she, and she can speak to it, believe that the division, did anything that was excessive in terms of how it conducted the recount. There was a machine recount with a testing at a representative number of precincts around the state, a testing of the machines by hand count. And so, and it confirmed that our equipment, the AccuVote equipment, is indeed accurate. And so the whole process for the recount conducted by the division was a reasonable one. And I think that might have just been an unfortunate use of a term that I wouldn't want you to misunderstand. That is the cost of a recount in Alaska, a full state recount plus another district recount.
Okay. Other questions before we go to mainframes?
Okay.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laura, as I try to listen carefully here, the things that caused some cost overruns and helped force this supplemental that you could not have controlled were the number of petitions, you know, that show up on the ballot. A recall, the increase or decrease in the number of requests for absentees, and recalls, those things you have, and so I'd be interested in what have those uncontrollable variables done to elections budgets in the past? I suspect that having these things show up like this has precedent.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, the division employees that have been around call me a magnet for the unprecedented. So there's not been five petitions being processed at the same time and elections going on. This is record. Absentee ballot, what we sent out, 87% higher than the previous presidential year. So you know there isn't an easy mark to compare it against. The last recount was requested in the, how do you name your candidates, Campbell Knowles. Statewide recount, and that was conducted in Anchorage. That's because that's where part of the division was located at the time. So there, simultaneously, you don't see that. The last time the division came back for a rather large supplemental was related, most of you were here, to the reapportionment, and that's always an incredible expenditure for the division.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Green?
I just wanted to, we looked it up, it was in 1986, for whomever asked the date of the enactment of the 750-10,000 bond. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Huffman?
Mr. Chairman, going back to some of your first comments regarding the $304,000 for the additional 13 workers on the petitions that required a lot of overtime, what period did these 13 workers that averaged $23,000 cover? $23,000 each.
Senator Huffman, through the chair, again, it's not just the temporaries. It's also overtime costs to those election employees, and that's all through the fiscal year. So it's through 05. I can't go back and look. So those charges are those that have accumulated only in fiscal year 05 to date.
Okay, then what was the cost attributed to the additional 13 workers then that you had to hire as to address the petitions that you mentioned?
Senator Huffman, through the chair, you would like me to separate out the difference between overtime versus the temporaries?
Well, a breakdown maybe of the 13, their regular work and their overtime work.
Senator Huffman, through the chair, I'm told that's a rather difficult process, but we could work on getting you that breakdown.
So you don't have those figures to justify your request today?
No, sir.
If the committee, let's let her finish her summary sheet, then we'll come back with general questions, if that's okay. Okay, Laura, mainframe chargebacks?
Mainframe chargebacks. As you all may know, our database that we work on to process petitions and absentee is based on the mainframe, and our usage on it during this year was excessive. Early cost estimates were at $23,000. I looked at another number yesterday, and we're up over $26,000, and that's in a comparison, you know, election fiscal year versus in 03 versus FY05. Again, we were on the mainframe more processing the absentee requests, the facts. All of that is done on the database, which means time on the mainframe. And time on the mainframe is done not just in the director's office with the 13 plus temporaries, but also in regions, the four regions in the state, as they do voter history and voter registration. Expedited forms, including freight costs, again, because there was so much interest in absentee by mail, and so many people, Alaskans who chose to participate, again, we were kind of blindsided by one of the drives. We had to ante up, get the forms printed, and get them out, and that required additional forms that, again, we're up 87%. We didn't anticipate that kind of participation and had to freight them up. Postage costs up $19,000. Again, we mailed two ballots, and most of those, for any in the municipality of Anchorage, those are, you know, municipality will reimburse us those costs. But again, it was a higher postage cost this year. And then, as you probably heard, with the increased interest in absentee, we also had an increased interest in fax voting, and our main server was overloaded, and we freighted up two additional fax presses, opened up 16 lines, again, with increased interest by the voters in voting by fax. So, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman, that's a quick run-through.
Questions on the summary sheet? Senator Bundy?
Thank you. And in a way, we should be glad to see the supplemental if it's driven by increased voter participation. I mean, that is, you know, the price of democracy, I would say, and an embarrassment. We, in the past, haven't had higher turnouts. So the questions I asked aren't aimed at that. I'm disappointed that we had so many people voting, but it's just, I think, important that we gather more information and so we have a better view of what the cost of elections are. And as you point out several times, there's a substantial increase in applications for absentees. In part, I think, because of the political activities of the various parties, has really encouraged this. And again, if that results in turnout, that's fine. But I believe I've seen in the paper, and perhaps you've got information about the percentage of absentees that are actually used. And do you have that information of the requested for absentee ballots?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, it's not easy to calculate that, and the reason I say that is I can tell you how many requests came in and then how many we processed. This year we had, I think it's over 300% increase in special advance ballots, and what that means is each voter who requests a special advance ballot gets a ballot where they can write in the candidates and then a follow, and that's done within 60 days prior to an election, and then they're also sent an official absentee ballot. That voter gets two, may send two back, may only send one back. We only count one. But still, that's going to skew your numbers. There are absentee voters that we had a good many calls from voters who signed some of the absentee ballot applications thinking they were filling out a voter registration form and didn't know why they got an absentee ballot in the mail. So they, you know, I want to vote at my polling place, right? How come I have to do this? And we had to explain you don't have to do that. So to make a fair comparison, it's been very frustrating to me because I would like to deliver to the Lieutenant Governor very clear lines and an understanding and to all of you, but I found in this new job it's not as easy to do because there are human factors and you don't know everyone's reason whether they choose to participate by mail or not.
I really wasn't concerned about why they didn't participate. I was just wondering how many. You sent out X number of absentees and you got X number back. What percentage of what you sent out did you actually get back?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I guess I was wrapping the two together. We received, I think, almost 50% back, but again, that number skewed because we try and get those numbers cleaned up, and if you've got duplicate ballots, see, if I sent out two to some people, it means that over 59,000 number is high, but you only get half back. That doesn't mean they didn't all participate. It meant they actually did exactly what we expected, and so those percentages, maybe a better answer is our database doesn't separate special advance so that I can query special advance from absentee by mail and give you percentages of whether that voter voted with two ballots or one and then calculate out.
If I might continue, and maybe I'm going down this trail that doesn't give firm answers, but go a little bit further in that. As I said earlier, I think part of the absentee boom was generated by partisan political activity, and is there a cost to your office generated by this partisan activity? When we get an absentee ballot request that has gone through a party, is that somehow separated out from an absentee request that just came from an individual?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I'm going to try and anticipate what you're asking. Both major parties did absentee ballot drives. I'm just going to talk as though they're teams on a field. I'm not picking a side. The Republicans were the first, did their drive in the primary and did a follow-up drive in the general. As you said, increased voter participation does cost the state. That's correct. But all of us, I think that's a good thing. What happened with the Democratic Party's mailer was it didn't go directly to the state. When the voter filled it out, it went to the party first, and then it came to us. That caused delays and exceptional costs and stress on the division because there were times where we were getting an application that had been signed by a voter a month prior to it being delivered to our office, so we couldn't process it as timely as had it come directly to us. There were costs in returning phone calls. There were ballot applications, again, Democratic Party applications that had been altered with a sticker. And as a result, because the voter had attested to information and then information had been added after the voter signed, we felt we had a legal obligation to make contact with that voter and say, is this information correct? Because, you know, the party database may not have been accurate. It added a residence address for a voter and perhaps it was incorrect. So we sent out, we were going to call and notify those voters and thought it wasn't, we wouldn't have proof that we did it. Instead, we chose to do a priority mailing to almost 1,000 voters with the opportunity to vote by fax and to ask them to contact that division, the division. So yes, there were costs wrapped up. We did not, as I testified in Senate State Affairs, we did not separate out the costs per party or per application. We were so driven just to get the applications processed that I chose not to set them aside and make totals for comparison, but instead just to get the voters processed.
Thank you. And again, no criticism is intended in my questions. If I might, Mr. Chairman, the thrust of where I'm going, and I'm not sure it's possible, but at a later date, if you could let me know, if the parties are generating, the party, this is not the individual, the party is generating a cost to the Division of Elections, I would look favorably at information from you that will we might create a charge or some reimbursement for that cost that parties are creating for you. And no criticism of the parties is intended either. I'm glad for increasing voter participation, but if they are excess costs, it needs to be discussed. So, thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond to that. We are supporting some changes to law this year to address some of that where some of the party activity caused an increase in costs that we believe shouldn't have been there, the activity shouldn't have taken place. When I learned about some of this activity, I immediately stepped in and requested, I sent a cease and desist order. The party said that they followed the order, they agreed to follow it. But there were a number of costs associated with it, as Director Glazer talked about. We asked them to have a division employee accompany them to the post office to take these cards. That, of course, took time away from other activities. There were the costs associated with callbacks and mailings. And then, of course, as she said, just the batching of, and I stopped by the division a few times during this time, and I saw hundreds, perhaps thousands, of applications just coming in batches. And that made it difficult to program the workload, and it meant that she had to hire these temporary people. They were set up at workstations, just basically swamped the division. And so we are supporting some changes. I know that Senator Terrio has suggested some changes. The governor has a bill in as well that addresses some of these.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question goes to, you know, obviously we want as many people to turn out as possible and have their votes counted, but in reading the paper, there was one point that 2,500 absentee ballots were held up in the Juneau Post Office because of the lack of postage and underestimation of the number of ballots by. There were over 1,000 ballots more than what was turned in, and I was wondering what the division has done to assure that this type of problem won't occur in the future.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, it's a human process, and we've all made mistakes, and it was arranging temporary who made a mistake. when they were filling out the paperwork. It was not a lack of postage. The state has postage paid. It was an accounting error. It was filling out the paperwork at the post office. We've assumed and accepted, well, not even accepted the criticism, but the post office also needs to step in as well and say, you know, they didn't call us right back. We were in our offices, well, at that time, till 1:32 in the morning easily. Our election coordinator was sleeping on the floor, so she could get up every once in a while and call people overseas. So she had been in charge of this area, was available, and was not contacted till the next day. So when you ask what we've done to change it, the temporary felt sick. We all feel bad, but it was a mistake. And
you know, you say it wasn't underestimation of the ballots or the not adequate postage, but that's exactly what the postal clerk stated, that that was the case. It said the division underestimated the ballots by 1,041, and the postage was estimated to be $910.37 when the actual postage was $1,827.97. This is according to the postal clerk in Juneau.
Lieutenant Governor? This is an unfortunate event for all of you who, like me, have ever done bulk mailing, and I don't know if you have personally done it. I know I have, and I quickly decided I didn't like to do bulk mailing and let other people do it. But they're very strict in terms of the count, to make sure that the count of the pieces is indeed the same as the number of pieces. And in this case, the state obviously was good for the postage. I would dare say that the state of Alaska is the largest customer the United States Post Office has in Juneau, and there never was any question about the postage. The sad part was, is when that mistake was made, a lower level person in the post office decided to hold that mailing up rather than elevate that to the postmaster. They have corrected that in the post office, and they have agreed that if something like that happened again, the postmaster would look at it and would make that decision, and that is how they should have handled it. It's unfortunate that it happened. It ended up being two human mistakes combined together held that up for another day, and we don't have direct evidence that caused anybody not to receive their ballot in time, but it certainly did cause some media attention, and it's unfortunate that it happened, because down at the last few days, we like to have as much time as possible to get these processed, to give people an opportunity to get their ballot.
Mr. Chairman? And I agree, but I've read, you know, I read Vanquish paper as well as probably everybody at the table, and there was numerous complaints about the absentee ballot processing. Is there any way of knowing of these 2,500 ballots that were held up, what percentage was actually returned in a timely manner?
The evidence that we can have is if people report that they did not get their ballot in time, which some people have. I have personally taken either somebody just mentioning to me in person or telephone calls, probably fewer than 20 people, voters, that did not get their ballots in time. Yesterday I took a telephone call about two people, and in my opinion, one person doesn't get their ballot in time is too many. And you know, we need to do everything we can to make sure we get that done. But I'm not sure that we've tabulated. I mean, we do have the information, and we'd be able to go back and see how many were in the batch of approximately 2,500, and if any of those people didn't get their ballot time, we'd be able to have that number. And I would guess that if, you know, whatever the number is of people who didn't get their ballots in time, it's going to be a portion of that number.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other general questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, as we look at this request here, we're talking about a fair amount of money. We're talking almost two-thirds of $1 million to go ahead and make up for what problems revealed themselves during the selection process. Is what's the lesson that we can learn so that the next time we're not looking at another special bill to go ahead and make sure that the Division of Elections is covered for unexpected expenses, unexpected delays, unexpected faults that happen outside the system? What improvements can we make to make sure that, well, even like this bill that was put out by the Madam Chairman, a bill from 1986, 20 years ago, has obviously got numbers that need to be reconsidered.
Thanks, Senator Olson, and through the chair. I wouldn't say that this request is before you just because of problems. A number of things lead to the request, and so it's not fair, as I know at least one media source has suggested, that the $694,000 request suggests mismanagement. That's not correct. They're just not telling the truth. It's a number of things that lead to it that we've talked about already, and part of it is the spectacular success of attracting new voters. I believe that's a good thing. And if we could increase our voter turnout, and there's an associated cost with it, I believe that that's a good thing. But when you say, okay, what lessons do we learn? There is a cost associated with cooperation with the local government. If you run a concurrent election, there's a cost. We could have said no. In fact, there were some advising me that that would be an easier route to take. But I believe that we are in business to be user-friendly, and so I said, we ought to cooperate if we can, and if it's okay with the law. And we did, but there was over $100,000 associated with that. We're going to get the money, but you have to appropriate it for the division to be able to spend it and pay the bills, and then we have to receive it on the other hand. In terms of lessons to be learned, the other things, the recall is not something we can, you know, the division really has any direct control over. The bond requirements for a recall, recount is something that probably ought to be addressed. In my opinion, when you ask for a recount, when you really have no legitimate basis for concluding that you can produce a different result, this was not like the Washington election, where out of 2.6 million votes, you're within 200 votes. That one certainly is legitimate. I don't know that the conclusion was legitimate, but the request was legitimate in terms of, you know, because you don't know who really won in that case. In this case, before us, the margin was way outside of that. The end result was practically the same as the first count. And so you say in a case like that, should the requester bear responsibility for it, that's going to be a policy call that you're going to be asked to address. And I believe that we ought to address it. There are some other issues, if we get into it, on the reprint of the ballots and associated costs, that I'd be happy to be happy to talk about that. There are some lessons to be learned from that experience for the future. So I'd say yes, there's some lessons to be learned as well.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my question has to do with what can we do to, as a legislative body, to improve the process, as opposed to lessons learned, so we have a smoother system for your director, a smoother system for those subordinates that are under her, to make sure that things do run in a more expeditious manner and not subject to the criticism of the outside.
Well, Chairman and Senator Olson, we've talked about several of those already as we've gone through here. The changes to be made so we're not batching absentee ballot requests, so they're coming in. It's almost like a bell curve. You know what a bell curve looks like when you're coming in and then high and then coming down. If you're having to manage just for the peak, and you have to deal with that, then you have to have temporaries, you know, in the staff to handle that. But if you allow it over a longer period to come in and deal with that and process over a longer period, you can do it with fewer temporaries, and you can just manage better. Some of the changes that are being proposed will enable that to happen, and that's going to enable the division to do, I think, a better job and keep its costs down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? I have four. First, on your summary sheet, Laura, I don't understand $300 in CIP receipts has been reduced for management reporting purposes. What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, I might have to have the governor's admin office come and speak to that as they prepared the sheet. Okay. But my guess is that the CIP receipts are the receipts for the Help America Vote Act coordinator. We have staff, and we also put in the budget that we would hire another Help America Vote Act, another person who would be paid through Help America Vote Act. We chose not to do that as the coordinator at that time left the division, and I saw no reason to bring in two new staff. We didn't have time to train. Mm-hmm. So
the CIP.
My first guess is all right with you. I would say it's because it's been removed in the calculation of total numbers, because first of all, we didn't hire that additional HAVA staff, mm-hmm. and the other fact is that those are monies directly from the election fund to cover the HAVA coordinator.
So does CIP receipts mean HAVA money?
Yes, sir.
Same thing?
Yes.
So federal money. Okay. Second question, in the cell that says obligated under account number 73,000 services, $187,599, that's been obligated, who would we still owe money to? Who is that obligated to?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to have Linda Perez come up and join us. In my chair.
For the record, I'm Linda Perez, Administrative Services Director for the Governor's Office. Those contractual encumbrances would reflect a number of
things. Of course, you have a microphone if you would, please, Linda.
The 73,000 line contractual encumbrances would reflect a number of things. They would reflect anything that we had contracted to purchase when we had not been billed yet. They would reflect our RSA agreements with the Department of Administration for the chargebacks, for computer services, for the central mail room, for phones. It's all of those operating costs that are reflected there that have not yet been billed.
And is most, what percent of the roughly 187,000 is for outside vendors?
I'd have to get that back to you, Mr. Chairman. I don't
know. An estimate?
I truly don't have an estimate, but I'll provide
that. So it's outside vendors plus interagency chargebacks between departments?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, thank you for your help. Well, how much, when you look at your summary sheet of the 805,000, have you given some thought how much of this will roll into the FY07 budget?
Mr. Chairman, yes, if you're asking, and somewhat to Senator Olson's question, how can you help, is to anticipate, again, when we had a year of multiple unprecedented occurrences, you want to budget somewhat to be prepared, but on the other hand, you know, not over budget. So yes, we're looking at that. We're looking at, you know, five petitions. We'll start to hear activity. I think you might have read in the paper. We just got a new, or the Lieutenant Governor just received an application for a new petition. So we'll start gauging that in time frame and when it could hit. But again, some sponsors deliver a petition back way before their year is up, the statutory year, to gather signatures. Some go right to the deadline. So yes, we're looking at those items, and yet to say that everything would happen exactly this year may not be the case. We do look at presidential to presidential. To be honest, it will make a difference whether we have men and women overseas serving our country. That adds to absentee. And so, you know, yes, we will look at those things in '07 and come to you with our best estimates, seeing what happened in fiscal year '05 to what could happen in '07.
Thank you. And my last question, does voter participation in '04, how did it compare to '00 and, say, '96? Do you know those numbers off the top of your head?
No, sir, I left that sheet. I just know that this was the highest ever. We're at 66%. We were in the 50s before. You're talking about 66% voter turnout when we purged over 24,000 voters in February of this year. We did 170,000 new voter registration applications in this fiscal year. So you're seeing real additional voters added to the process.
If you have those sort of numbers, what
yes,
may happen as this
yes.
marches through?
Yes.
This could be part of the file?
You bet.
Okay. Those are my questions. Any other questions? Senator Green?
Thank you, Senator Wilkin. Laura, on the letter of transmittal, there's a figure of 805,000.3. And in the horizontal sheet, there's the total expenditures, negative 717,500. And then the face of the bill, it's 694. Is that just a refined, scrubbed up number, or is there something backed out of these that we don't, I can't see?
Senator Green, through the chair, the bill is asking you for what we, the division, believe we need to operate. The 717.5 is our projection. We're trying to, we want to work that back to 694, and we will, but we gave you an honest projection. That's what you asked for, and we gave you the projection, and as a manager, I'm going to manage down to the 694. The 805 are real costs. Some of that has been absorbed into the division, and so that's why the numbers are, you see the differences in the numbers.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Governor, did you want to address the ballot reprinting issue?
I'd be happy to do so.
Would you please? Did
you want to ask a question?
Is that a question? That subject.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I had mentioned earlier that the ballot reprint was a situation that didn't have to happen and, in my opinion, shouldn't have. And let me explain, and there's a rather long story to this, and I don't know how much of the story you want to hear. I think some of you probably are aware of it, but I think a refresher is probably good because it ultimately comes back to what Senator Olson asked about, is what lessons have we learned, and, you know, how can we either avoid something like this in the future, or how can we plan for it in case we have something similar. What ended up happening is there was a group that was formed with, and the sponsors were three legislators from the House, formed a group that they called Trust the People, and it had to deal with the Senate vacancy initiative. The legislature decided once this group had gathered its signatures, and there's a whole history before that of time, but it doesn't really affect the Division of Elections and its costs, and so I'm going to just move fast forward to where it begins affecting the division. But the legislature stepped in and established by policy that there would be a special election to replace a vacancy in the United States Senate. The House and the Senate passed this, went to conference committee, and at that time the chairman of the conference committee, Representative McGuire, asked me for an opinion on would the measure that the conference committee was considering be considered to be substantially similar to the initiative. And the rationale there is if it were considered substantially similar, then the initiative would be pulled from the ballot, wouldn't be on the ballot. My conclusion, with the agreement of the Department of Law and your own counsel, was that it would be similar, and the only difference, it was word for word exactly the same, the only difference was in what was called the temporary replacement language. The legislature one of the bodies had placed in, and the conference committee was considering a provision that would allow the governor to name a temporary replacement who would serve from the time of the vacancy until the special election could be conducted and certified and the member seated. In other words, would be able to fill that time period that in a timeline is from 3 to as long as 6 months, perhaps slightly longer than 6 months, that would be vacant. And I announced that, put that in writing in a letter to Representative McGuire. That went to the conference committee. It was no surprise to anybody. There was no discussion at the conference committee that I'm aware of, no dissension from the sponsors on this. They didn't question it. In fact, the sponsors voted for the legislation, and they voted for the conference committee report when it came back to the legislature. When I followed up and actually honored what I said I would do when the bill became law, and then I formally sent the letter to the sponsors saying that this was going to be pulled from the ballot, they, through their counsel, sued. It was a direct confrontation, not only to me as Lieutenant Governor, but to you as a legislature in the action that you took. They sued and said that it wasn't similar, substantially similar. The Supreme Court of the state of Alaska, in late August, issued a decision that said, place this on the ballot. And then they said, ruling to follow. Here we are, but when I received the written decision from the Supreme Court, by the way, the day before the primary election, lots of things happening. We had 3 days between that time when we received the written, that written decision, and when we had to have the language to the division elections to get to the printer to meet the statutory deadline of 60 days before the election for special advance ballots. We had to have the language. And the Supreme Court said ruling to follow. So what did their ruling, what did it mean? Obviously, it didn't mean what it said on its face. The issue was no longer about a special election. You had already taken care of that. That's the law. The issue then, I concluded, and some of our counsel, we had to engage in counsel, the discussions with the Department of Law, and some of the counsel said their ruling does nothing. their decision does nothing. I mean, if the initiative passes, it does nothing. And my conclusion, maybe it's the engineer in me, said it has to do something or else they wouldn't say to do it. And my conclusion was that it would repeal the temporary replacement language. Therefore, I so stated that to the Department of Law. We talked about it and concluded that it did, and we devised language that met the test, I believe, of being fair and impartial, which is the test. It has to be true. It has to be accurate. And we have to pass a test on ballot language. We did that. We got the language to the Division of Elections. They had the ballots printed, and we posted the language on the website. It was at least 2 weeks later, after the ballots not only had been printed but were distributed, that this group called Trust the People then started objecting to the ballot language and then ultimately sued over the ballot title and the ballot language. And Judge Morgan Christen, who heard the case, agreed with them, at least in part, and she said that the language was inaccurate and that it was biased. With all due respect to the third branch of government and to Judge Christen, she's wrong on the first part. She did not understand, in my opinion, the timeline for what it takes to run an election and to certify. And so she never explained her statement that it was inaccurate. But even this election cycle has proved what I've said many times, that it will take approximately the full month to count the ballots, count the absentees, certify an election, and so it'll take at least 3 months, you know, because we had the 60 days, you know, to place the election, it would do it. So Judge Kristen was wrong in that count. On the other, it was her opinion that stating the perhaps the obvious, that during the time of the conduct of this election, the state of Alaska will be without representation in the United States Senate. That, I believe, struck a happy medium between what the sponsors wanted. Essentially, they wanted it to say, during this, you know, we're going to have a special election, so the governor can't name his replacement or keep his hands off of this. The other extreme could be to say, you have an election and you're going to have the party bosses able to name the nominees in closed door sessions. We didn't believe either of those approaches was appropriate, and the better approach was just to clearly state what is happening and what the impact was of that action. We did that. She came up with her decision, and it was so close to the end to where it was actually jeopardizing the delivery of ballots to our overseas, our distance voters, which we believe is very important to this election cycle. And so rather than challenge that decision up to the Supreme Court, we agreed to reprint the ballots and entered into a quick two-day session with the sponsors to come up with language that we believe would be accurate, but that the court would accept. And in the end, the irony of all of this is the court agreed with the language we proposed and rejected the continued objections of the Trust the People attorney. Even in the end, they, you know, they were objecting to the ballot language and accepted what we proposed, and that went on the ballot. Now, the irony of all of this is, of course, the result probably didn't change substantially had the ballot language never been changed in the first place, but at tremendous cost to the state to satisfy whatever reason the people were bringing this suit, I believe was something that was unnecessary and shouldn't have happened. And I'm sorry for getting into a lot more detail perhaps than you'd like to hear about this, but you know, I think it's important to step through, you know, the results, the timeline, and all of these things that happen, because it's important to know that these decisions aren't made in a vacuum. They're made with counsel, and you know, and we're consulting very reasonable, learned people in the Department of Law from their experience and from legal, you know, their legal precedents are giving us advice in what to do. The net result is the thing that we got to recognize is that courts are just like us. They're made up of people. Judges have entered into these things with their own biases, just like we do, in their own backgrounds, and they will analyze things you know, from that background the same way we do. And what I consider to be fair and impartial, somebody else may consider to be otherwise. And you know, and I believe if anybody just looks at the language, they can see on its face that what was proposed before was indeed a fair statement. It was truthful, and it's one that should have been allowed to go forward. I think that I probably covered enough detail in there for you, and I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Questions? Questions of Ms. Glazier?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, pardon me, Senator Hoffman.
One other question, I guess. In the backup, there's two documents, one the memoranda and one this sheet right here. What's the difference between the the two figures on personnel services. It says here that on June 31, 2005, that the deficit on personnel services, the $717,000 that Ms. Green referred to earlier, it says that the personnel services are $618,000, but in the memorandum it says the additional personnel services are $304,000. What's the discrepancy in almost well over a doubling of that amount of 304?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, the memo that discusses 304,000 is the amount that exceeded prior year's temporary and overtime costs. The other document that you're referring to are real costs and projected costs that include that 304,000.
So the 304,000 is just a comparison between 02 and 04's budgeted items, and the $618,000 is what you anticipate the additional services will be. And I guess I don't need it today. I don't know what the chairman plans on doing, but at least before the floor, if I could, you had mentioned that there were some 13 additional workers that were hired. If my office can get a breakdown of that $618,000, it would be appreciated.
Mr. Chairman, and where does the 618 show, Senator Hoffman?
71,000 personal services.
Help me out.
There's two different.
Show me where.
Here, personnel services.
Oh, there. Okay.
Thank you, Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lieutenant Governor, the issue of having to redo the ballots because of the court decisions on a petition on the replacement of the U.S. Senator, kind of a perfect storm of unfortunate events there. And further to Senator Hoffman Olson's questions about what can we learn and what can we do, you know, to preclude this sort of thing in the future. Should we have some kind of a process so that if, as in this case, a petition was certified, the legislature enacted what arguably they thought was substantially the same, and that you were going in good faith forward on that, that there be some formal process for the petitioners to say, yes, we agree that that's similar, or we disagree, and some finite time limits on that in order to preclude the collapsing of a timeline here and the very unfortunate timing of their decision to contest that. I said that awkwardly, but I think what you understand what I'm getting at.
Yes, Senator Dyson, I understand what you're saying. I reach back into my own experience, and I recall, this may have been close to 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, when another group called, the acronym is FRANK, and it had to do with campaign finances, contributions, had proposed, actually gathered the signatures to bring this to the legislature. And then Senator Kelly was at least the spearhead behind a legislative effort to pass something substantially similar, because as you probably know, I'm sure you all know, that things done by initiative often are not done even to the level of care that you do in the legislative process. You don't pass perfect law, but certainly it isn't done by initiative because you don't have as much of the review process to do it. And so he was interested in passing a measure that's substantially similar, but corrected some of the deficiencies in the initiative. Along the way, the applicants or the sponsors or their counsel were able to participate, and in the end, at least informally, they gave the nod and even, I think, stated perhaps at this table or at some table that they would accept that as being substantially similar and didn't contest it later. That perhaps can and should be done. In this particular case, if I look at the background, and one of the sponsors was on the conference committee, did not object to the language. In fact, it was a member of his own party in committee that offered the amendment that put this in. There were no objections noted, no objections noted on the floor. In fact, they voted for it. I think it's fair that any of you could assume, as I did, that they accepted it, and they didn't object to my letter, didn't come back and say, hold it, you know, this isn't the same. Had they done that, then I think we, you know, because I've been asked this question before. One of the media asked me, what did you learn? And I said, well, if I knew the court was going to apply a different standard from what it had before, that essentially you have to pass something practically exactly the same, then my advice to the legislature would have been, if you want this to come off the ballot, then pass it in a different format, deal with the other issue later, and, you know, so I'd say learn something from that experience. The other is that we have, I have, and I know my predecessors have, at least had an informal process for reviewing ballot language with proponents and opponents. You know, we just say, look, this is the language, this is what I'm proposing. If you want to comment on it, provide your comment. I may accept the comment, I may not. And the same thing is true of former Lieutenant Governor Ulmer. I know, because she called me on one or two issues, and I differed with her on the writing. I said, Fran, this is not a fair characterization of the language. You know, and I told her why. She didn't choose to accept my language. I chose not to challenge her. I defined her position as Lieutenant Governor to write the language. And so we do have those processes in place.
Sorry, guys. Yeah, maybe I stated my question poorly. Should we have a formal process wherein the folks who put forth the petition are asked yes or no? Do you agree that the legislature's efforts is substantially the same or not? And secondly, this is the language that is going on the ballot. Do you agree or not? And have a date certain at which they have to do their review and respond, and after which their objections are precluded, to avoid the telescoping of the time frame that you guys got trapped in, whether or not that was done deliberately to embarrass you.
Yeah, I think that probably would be a fine thing to do, and it comes back to what something former Representative Barnes told me years ago. He said, all you have here as legislators is your trust, and you know, you need to honor your word. And so if we believe from experience, and if we look forward in the future and believe that it's possible that somebody may not honor a trust agreement, either a tacit approval or one that you know, is more formalized, then I think it would be a good thing to have as public policy a, you know, something in place that just says you must be involved and you must state your objection. Now, it still allows the lieutenant governor, according to the statute, the lieutenant governor still has deference in writing the language. Even the court agrees with that. And unless you want to take that away, which, you know, after the experience I went through, I'd say, have at it. It's not exactly one of my more fun things to do. But, you know, I take my responsibility seriously, and if you care to do that, it probably would help eliminate situations like this in the future.
If, then may I imply from your last sentence that this administration is not going to initiate legislation to formalize the process and preclude these kind of things in the future?
Well, I don't know that I will, you know, submit it as a governor's bill or propose it be submitted. I will be happy to work with you. If there's somebody who cares to take that on, we will support you and back up and working with you on that. My advice to the governor has been to reduce the number of bills, you know, just because of time, and so I don't know that I would suggest that as administration bill, but I certainly, you know, look favorably at working with you on coming up with a timeline and a way to reduce it.
Thank you, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you're well aware, Senator Dyson and I trade turns of being cynic, and it's my week. So, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, I think I heard you say that, in this case, the language was similar, if not substantially similar, between the initial effort and the final product. And would we come up with some legislation that would say the parties have to agree? I doubt we could preclude a third party from ever suing. And in this case, at least in my mind, and I guess you have the right to choose to comment or not, it would have seemed as if the suit had at least as much goal of perpetuating headlines as it did as changing actual language. Is that too cynical?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Bundy, I guess you could come to your conclusion about what the motivations were. I'll read from a letter that I'm sure is in the public record someplace. I didn't put it in the record, but I assume the recipient probably did. I wrote it to Representative Croft at the time, you know, there was this interaction going on, and the last paragraph says, "I am reticent to question your motives because I do not like it when you question mine. However, when I look at your entire track record on this initiative, I conclude that you could be more interested in politicizing this initiative rather than enacting good public policy. I was even reluctant to say that much, but I believed at the time that it was clear to me, if you look at the entire package, that was what was happening. I'm very reticent to question the motivations of legislators or anybody else, because I like to operate in good faith with people, and I trust that they were doing the same with me."
I contended at the time, and still contend, that the appointed senator's last name began with K. I think it's an alphabetical problem, and I trust the people would have not ever emerged.
Right, Senator Bundy. No, we're not going to get into political statements, but Senator Huffman.
Too late.
It's too late, yes.
My question goes to the fast-tracking bill here. In the past, we've had fast-track legislation on a myriad of issues, and I guess this seems a little bit unusual that we just have one on the Division of Elections. Has your office received information on other fast tracks, or is this the fast track? Are we going to have any additional fast tracks on the Marine Highway System or the fire suppression or others? And if this one isn't funded, you know, it's not to criticize our work, but fast tracks sometimes pass in May. What's the urgency of this particular appropriation?
We haven't formalized the other fast track. This is on a very fast track because the track ends at the end of February, and so it's the expectation that this legislation will flow through the legislature and be approved, and they'll have their funding by the end of February, and won't become a bill that gets entangled in other things. So hopefully this will just go through, and the other ones will start to put those together here in the next few weeks. And I think all of us have a sense of that supplemental. It's much more difficult and much more expensive than this one.
So this is a real fast track?
This is a very fast track.
It's super fast.
No, real fast track. Okay. Oh.
Oh, so those are only half.
Half fast track, yes. Thank you. Okay, other questions of the Lieutenant Governor or Director Glazier?
One final question, I guess. Are any of the, are any legal costs in the Department of Law is different, are any legal costs in this supplemental for?
The legal costs in there are for the independent counsel related to the Senator Ogun recall. And I do not believe that any of the other legal costs are in this supplemental request.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Okay. Will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 62 out of committee with individual recommendations.
An objection to passing Senate Bill 62 from committee? Seeing none, Senate Bill 62 passes from committee. Before we talk about tomorrow, anything else coming before the committee? Tomorrow at 9:30, Senator Green is going to chair a meeting on, we're going to start our pros and cons overview. Anything you want to add to that? So come with your thinking hats on, and we'll get that all out on the table and current on pros and cons. With that, anything else? Thank you, Lieutenant Governor and Laura, for being with us this morning. We're adjourned.